and they are slowly evaporating. Well, slowly, it depends on, you know, in which stage you are. So this temperature goes like 1 over m. So if you have really large black holes, the temperature is teeny tiny, and really the black holes are slowly evaporating. So for astrophysical black holes, this is completely irrelevant effect. But then as the black hole is getting smaller and smaller, the temperature increases, and then if you have teeny tiny black holes, then you just would see a burst of radiation, and the black hole would disappear. All right, so now one remark is that, well, you see something like an acceleration here divided by 2 pi. So there is a very similar effect to Hawking effect, which is called Andrew effect, or Andrew radiation. And that basically says that if you accelerate, so if there is some acceleration, then also the accelerated observer will perceive non-trivial thermal bars. He will perceive non-trivial temperature. And so the formula is exactly basically the same. So now the temperature of the thermal bath is given by how fast you're accelerating. So this is really the true acceleration. Acceleration of the observer. And this will be true even in flat space. So really, if you start accelerating here and now, and you accelerate really, 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 really fast, then you can, for example, cook a chicken by just, you know, going really, really fast. And so you don't really need curved spacetime. And it turns out that you actually don't even need horizons or something like that. That really, you know, you can sort of formulate this effect even without an infinite, without having acceleration for infinite amount of time, in which case you have the Rindler horizon, and then you can say, well, this is the temperature of that Rindler horizon. But in fact, a similar effect is also observed if you accelerate for a finite time. Okay? So anyway, so you will play with the Andrew radiation in your tutorial tomorrow. So you will derive this beautiful formula, and you will also derive the formula for the entropy of the Rindler horizon. So basically, you will study black holes, but now in flat space. OK? Questions? And maybe one more remark. Number two. So here, C tutorial tomorrow. And then remark number two is that, well, we have already established that the entropy for Schwarzschild black hole, so for Schwarzschild the entropy goes like r plus square, so it's pi r plus square, horizon radius square, and this is proportional to m square, so r plus is proportional to m. But the temperature goes like 1 over m. So this goes like 1 over t square. Okay, so then if you calculate what is the heat capacity of the Schwarzschild black hole, so C, which is t times ts over dt, so that's the capacity, or specific heat, well then, this thing here, well, s goes like 1 over t square. So if you differentiate that, you have minus 1 over t cube times t. So there will be so this is equal to, and then precisely there's also some factor. Let's just put that factor here. But it has to go like 1 over t square, right? And what is very important is this minus here. It of course, comes from differentiating 1 over t square. And so this is negative. So heat capacity or specific heat it's negative, which is something you don't know from ordinary thermodynamic systems. So ordinary thermodynamic systems will have positive specific heat. So black holes are very exceptional in this sense. And what it also means is that you cannot have stable thermal equilibrium. So if you put a black hole, Schwarzschild black hole, in a bath of radiation of the same temperature, and suddenly you say, well, suddenly, so this is in, you know, some equilibrium for some time. But now what happens if the black hole absorbs more of this radiation? So if it absorbs more radiation, it becomes more massive. But because it becomes more massive, the temperature of the black hole decreases. So now the temperature of the black hole is smaller than that of radiation. So the black hole wants to accept, you know, absorb more radiation. And so basically, if there is any fluctuation in your equilibrium, then it drives you away from the configuration. So black holes, Schwarzschild black hole, is thermodynamically unstable. Schwarzschild is thermodynamically unstable. Okay, and so similarly, you know, so even if there was a thermal equilibrium with the surrounding radiation or with the surrounding whatever bath, then, you know, teeny tiny fluctuation will drive it away from this equilibrium. Okay, questions? Yes.
I guess before you move on. What about other types of black holes?
Oh, very good. That's a very good question. And I wouldn't be mentioning this if there were no exceptions to this rule. So this is true for Schwarzschild. That's why I'm stressing it for Schwarzschild. As we shall see, black holes in ADS can behave differently. And that's why black holes in ADS are nice. And we will discuss that probably in next lecture, but maybe at the end of this lecture, we shall see.
Is there anything different about Kerr black holes or?
So if you start adding charge and stuff like that, let's see. I would have to remind myself how the diagrams look like. But the Schwarzschild has definitely negative specific heat. If you start putting rotation and charge and, you know, ADS, some black holes may be stable and may have positive specific heat. But you know, we would have to draw the corresponding diagrams and calculate the corresponding specific heat. But yeah, so the simplest Schwarzschild black hole is unstable. So now we know that the black holes actually will cause some information loss. And so classically, this is obvious. So classically, you take an elephant, which has lots of information in it, and then you throw it into the black hole. Of course, during this process, some of the information about the elephant is radiated away in gravitational waves and stuff like that. But most of the information simply disappears underneath the horizon. And the black hole simply, as a response, becomes a little bit bigger. But we know that every black hole looks alike. They are just distinguished by these three charges, mass, charge, and angular momentum. And so, you know, it just jumps in mass, let's say, by absorbing the elephant. And then you can throw in something different than elephant there, which has the same mass. The response of the black hole is the same, right? But we seem to have lost the information that in one case we have thrown in the elephant, in the other case we have thrown in the car or something like that, right? So classically, this is, you know, classically. A black hole just gets bigger as it absorbs stuff. And so really you are losing the information about, you know, what it absorbed, right? So information about what it absorbed is lost. Okay. So now you may think, well, quantum mechanically, we may save the day. So if if the black hole actually radiates away something, then maybe the information starts coming out, right? So if I throw in the elephant, then after some time, there's this Hawking radiation coming out. Maybe I can pick up, you know, all these Hawking radiation quanta and recover the information about the elephant. However, this is not true according to Hawking's calculation, because the Hawking radiation is exactly thermal. And as you know, thermal radiation simply only is described by this temperature, but the temperature is given by the mass. So even quantum mechanically, you are still getting only information about the mass of the black hole. So Hawking radiation is thermal. And in the simplest case, again, T is proportional to 1 over m. So we are not really getting any information out. It's really getting out as well. Okay. So it seems like really the black holes actually, you know, absorb information and they don't give it back. Okay. And so then there's this sort of, yes?
For the information thing, like quantum mechanically, I understood it as like the unitarity of the wave function. But classically, why do we not expect it? Like, why do we care if information is lost or not?
No, I'm just saying, you know, it absorbs the information in some sense. Classically, it absorbs the entropy as well, right? So you just throw in some things with the entropy and you know, classically, nothing happens, right? So you can just tidy your universe and clean it of all the mass and information. And I'm not saying there's no paradox here, right? I'm just saying it seems like there's an information loss, right? I'm not saying there's any paradox. Okay, not yet, okay? So now what people do is that actually they plot this, you know, so this all leads to the information paradox. And so for this, people draw the diagram which Hawking have drawn in the 1976, but there goes a lot of belief into that diagram. Okay, so the diagram may be completely wrong, so take it you know, with reservation. But anyway, so let's assume that black hole eventually evaporates. Surely, completely evaporates. Okay, and if that is true, then you can draw something like this diagram. So this is like Hawking, 1976. And since then, people are drawing the same diagram. And the diagram looks like this. I'll first draw it, and then we can discuss it. So it looks like this. And so this is the singularity of the hole. The singularity. I don't know if you have discussed in your GR course conformal diagram. So this is the conformal diagram for a collapsing matter. So here you start with some dust, and this dust simply goes up in time. So there's time evolution here. So this is, let's say, a collapsing star. And eventually, you know, this dust collapses to form a black hole. So you will have a horizon here. So this is the horizon, which is formed out of that. And you form the singularity here for the black hole. Okay. And then you may be asking what happens on different Cauchy slices of this universe. So this diagram, if you haven't seen it, so like there's a spatial infinity here, there's a past null infinity here. So, you know, null rays will be coming from this line. Spatial infinity is just this point here. It's basically like you take, your infinite diagram, which you know for Schwarzschild, and you compactify it to have a finite picture on a finite piece of paper. And this is the conformal diagram. So that's the spatial infinity, that's the time-like infinity here. And then if I draw one Cauchy slice, let's say before the dust really collapses here, so it would be some initial Cauchy slice. And so this is before the collapse, so this is still, you know, it goes through the matter of your collapsing star. And let's assume that at that point, everything is quantum mechanically in pure state. Sigma I has a pure state. Okay. And then, a little bit later, you form the black hole, you form the horizon. So now from the horizon, once you form it, you start seeing the Hawking radiation escaping over here. Okay, so that's the Hawking radiation, which escapes to infinity once you form the black hole. Okay, and you can think about, well, okay, first, just Hawking radiation. And then, you know, this Hawking radiation diminishes the black hole. The black hole is getting smaller and smaller. And eventually, at this point, it completely evaporates. That's the assumption here, okay? So the horizon sort of here is like 2 original m, and then m is decreasing, decreasing, decreasing. So it should be a little bit tilting up, but it's, well, people just draw a null line here. And then at this point, you assume that the black hole has completely evaporated. And so now you have a space-time, and there is no longer the black hole, but it's just filled with the Hawking radiation. Okay, so here, black hole evaporated completely. And in the end, if I draw a Cauchy slice in later time, so let's say this will be my Cauchy slice, sigma final, then there is no longer any black hole, it's just, you know, space filled is the Hawking radiation which escaped from the black hole. Okay. Okay. And because it's the Hawking radiation, which is thermal, your state is actually mixed. It's a thermal state, mixed state. So we have a mixed state. And so this is the information paradox. Basically, what it means is that you violated unitarity of the quantum mechanical evolution. You started with something which was in pure state, you evolved in time, and because of the presence of the black hole, you ended up with a mixed state later on of this Hawking radiation. And so now you started with, so this is really the pure state. Now you have the density matrix here describing your thermal state, and so this would result in unitarity, in the violation of unitarity evolution. So this leads to black hole information paradox. Which is basically violation of unitary evolution.
I was going to ask if there's like a canonical way to understand that from an outside observer's perspective, no one actually
calls. Ah, very good. So, yeah, it's definitely related to this. So, okay, thank you for that question. So now, you know, how people can think about this is precisely that picture which I was trying to draw at the last minute of last lecture. So you can think about this Hawking radiation as a sort of pair creation of particles. Of course, when you pair create particles, they'll be entangled quantum mechanically, right? But now what happens is that one of the particles, you know, stays inside a black hole, whereas the other one can escape to infinity as Hawking radiation. This pair is entangled. However, from the point of view of an observer who stays outside of the black hole, you don't have access to whatever happens inside. Well, you don't see what's happening behind the horizon, right? So in that sense, what you have, what the best you can do is that you trace out the states which are inside the inside the black hole horizon. Of course, if you trace out some part of the region, that's how you can create out of the pure state a density matrix role. Okay, so that's one explanation how you can, so you can think about this like that this comes from the fact that you don't have access to what happens underneath, but that underneath suddenly disappears, and so you never will get that access. And that's why you can violate the unitary evolution. Yes? What do you mean? So I just, you know, draw a Cauchy surface, which is something which contains all information about my space-time. And then I just look at, you know, what kind of state my matter is on that Cauchy surface. And you can create such a situation that everything is in pure state. So you can, of course, you can already start with a mixed state, but let's start with a pure state, why not? And then let's evolve in time, and somehow the presence of the black hole causes that you end up with a mixed state. So there's a density matrix row. Sorry? So at this point, there's no black hole. It's just the collapsing matter, and so you assume that collapsing matter is in pure state or whatever. Isn't this amazing? So now we have this big puzzle, and you know, that's from 76. It's really bothering people until now, and you know, ADS-CFT has something to say about this paradox, as we shall see at the end of this course. So I will return back to this information paradox, but let me just stress that, you know, there was this bet between Hawking and I don't know who, Thorne maybe, and other people, Preskill maybe. That really, so Hawking claims, well, there will be information loss, and other people claim, well, that they may not be. And then people are trying to devise various scenarios how this is not true, how you can evade this information paradox. And people, you know, came up with proposals like firewalls, and they came up with proposals like black hole remnants, that black hole actually never evaporates completely, and the information remains stored forever there. They came up with final bursts, so they said this picture is actually valid all the way until the very end of evaporation, in which case suddenly I will just throw out all the information which I stored for years there in a final burst of radiation and stuff like that. Of course, where the semi-classical picture which you are using here already breaks down, okay, and so on. But so one thing is sure, that at the ADS-CFT, so according to ADS-CFT, everything that I'm not using that blackboard again, happens in the space-time, is dual, or is exactly equivalent to what happens in quantum theory on the boundary. So CFT is like stands for conformal field theory, but it's just, you know, some quantum theory, and if that is true, so if this, you know, so this is still the ADS-CFT, still a conjecture, it hasn't been proved, and probably never will. But if this is true, then you know, we know that quantum field theory has to be unitary. Okay, so, well, at least that's what people know. It's unitary. So if this is true, then it cannot happen that in the space-time you would violate unitarity. Okay, and so it means that the info paradox must be wrong. And we have to restore unitarity. Okay. And so really this picture must be somehow wrong. And actually it was precisely this ADS-EFT conjecture which in the end convinced Hawking that maybe there's something wrong with his argument here. And then he said, well, if this is true, then really I cannot violate unitary evolution in the space-time. Okay? We have to restore unitarity. And what it also means is that the information has to start coming out of the black hole at some point. Okay, so it cannot be stored inside the black hole, as according to this picture, but it has to somehow, the Hawking radiation, it's not perfectly thermal, it carries some more information than thermality, and somehow, the information has to start coming out, so that in the end, if I collect all the Hawking radiation, I actually can restore my pure state, which I started with.
So I still don't really understand why we can assume the first initial slice is a pure state. Like, if you have a gravitating body, how can it be a pure state? Because, you can't have a localized, something is, gravitationally collapsing, it's localized, right? Like, how can it be a pure state?
If it's localized.
It cannot be.
But you can probably get as close as you can, as you want to a pure state, I think. So imagine that you have something which, you have collapsing dust, right? Which is, really spread it out. It's almost no gravity anywhere. It starts slowly collapsing and stuff like that. I think you can get, I don't know. I never seen anybody questioning this thing here. But maybe it's the right thing to question. I don't know. Yes?
So there's something I never quite liked about this state of the paradox. Because precisely due to something that you said a minute ago, there's nothing paradoxical about getting a mixed state at sigma f. Because sigma f is not a Cauchy's light for the whole spacetime. Right? So you're just tracing out some subsystem that you're throwing away infinitely in the singularity. But there's nothing paradoxical about it.
Very good, very good. No, that's very good. So you would be arguing that the right Cauchy slice is maybe this thing, or maybe, I don't know, that thing, or something like that, that this would be the right Cauchy slice to think about. Of course, what this picture really assumes is that eventually there won't be any singularity, right? Eventually, quantum gravity will replace the singularity with something else. So there will be some higher curvature region, which, however, and then this thing here will be somehow tilted like that or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's beyond semi-classical gravity.
Yeah, I agree.
Paradoxical with that description of semi-classical.
No, I agree with that. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, if you include the fact that the black hole has a finite dimensional Hilbert space, or if you believe that a black hole has a finite dimensional Hilbert space, given by the exponential of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, now that is much more problematic.
Yeah.
And that was the problem much earlier in the evaporation process.
Yeah, and we will discuss that. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, it's just that I think that is the paradox, not this.
Okay.
Something I'm always confused about is it seems like we're solving something in ADS-CFT and saying it solves the same scenario in Minkowski and DeSitter, right? Why is that?
Okay, so very good. That's another question. So here, of course, ADS-CFT only applies, strictly speaking, to ADS black holes and the CFT and stuff like that. So here you are saying, well, maybe it's a more general statement, right? So if this is true, then it would say that the ADS black holes actually have to have unitary evolution and stuff like that. But ADS black holes not so different from the asymptotically flat black holes. And people are trying to say that basically, you know, this holography is much more general than ADS CFT. So that's why people do flat space holography and the other, you know, other holography.
It's not necessarily a CFT. Like, the dual is not necessarily going to have these nice
properties. Exactly, but it'll be some quantum field theory. It will not be CFT, but it will be some quantum field theory. And as long as you believe that, you know, the quantum field theory is unitary, then it should somehow apply to Schwarzschild as well. It's a good question, and it's good to be skeptical, okay? So, yeah, thanks for that.
Assuming that in that case, like this space-time is also dual to a CFT, to some CFT?
To some quantum field theory, yeah. That you still assume that there is some kind of holography, which says whatever happens in the space-time happens to something which lives on the boundary of that space-time, which is described by some quantum field theory.
Not only the ADS CFT conjecture, but like an extra.
It's even more general than that. Okay, well, these are very good comments. Thank you so much. Very good. So now let me do a few comments on the black hole entropy. So we have seen last time that the black hole entropy is given by area over 4. And then if I restore the units, then it's C cube K Boltzmann divided by H bar and G Newton. So just to please Rob Myers, who likes to draw this picture here, what it means is that the black hole entropy is perfect thing to study your quantum gravity, because basically this formula knows about all of modern physics. It knows about the statistical physics. It knows about gravity. It knows about the quantum mechanics. And it knows about relativity. Okay. So this is really the key formula which you are getting from black holes, which somehow should be very, very important to push you forward to unify all these fields here. Okay, so notice that you can also, you probably remember from your other courses that Planck lengths is simply given by G Newton, H bar, C cube, square root of that. So let's simply, you know, if you take the constants, fundamental constants of nature, and then you try to form something which has units of length, this is it. So that's your Planck length. And then if you use it here, then you just see that the entropy is simply written as K Boltzmann divided by 4, and then the area divided by Planck length square. Okay. So what it means is that you can think about this horizon of the black hole as something that is divided into teeny tiny segments, okay, like this. And so this is a segment of the area L Planck square. And so basically, the black hole will carry that much entropy is that you divide the area into these very, very small segments, and you count how many of these segments are there, and that gives you the entropy of the black hole. And of course, L Planck square is very, very small, and the area of the black hole is big, so it means that the entropy is actually huge. So black holes carry a huge, huge entropy. And so maybe you read some books by Penrose who, like, eventually the universe entropy is dominated by black holes which are formed. Okay. For us, the most important thing is that this formula here is very, very strange from the point of view of ordinary systems. And the reason is that for ordinary systems, the entropy typically goes like volume. right? So the bigger the system you have, more entropy it carries. Here, the entropy goes rather like the area of the region surrounding the system. Okay, so formula is holographic like the area rather than volume okay, and again, this sort of motivated, you know, this ADS CFT, if you want, or the holographic idea in general, is because if you want to say that maybe the entropy of the spacetime is actually, you know, contained in this black hole entropy, then if you want this to be dual to some normal system with some normal, you know, where the entropy goes like volume, this normal system, the quantum mechanical system, has to be lower dimensional. Okay, so if this entropy is to be associated with entropy of a normal system, of normal quantum mechanical system, so this normal system better be lower dimensional. It has to have, it has to be three-dimensional rather than four-dimensional spacetime. And so really, you know, if you have, if the four-dimensional space-time is dual to something, which is like normal matter or whatever, then this normal matter cannot live in this space-time in four dimensions. It better live on three dimensions only, so that the volume, if you have three-dimensional system, including time, then the volume will be two-dimensional, so it will go like area. Okay, and so this is, again, a motivation for ADS CFT. There is also something which is called Bekenstein bound. So also motivated Bekenstein bound says that if you have any system, any whatever, quantum mechanical system or any other system, there is a bound of how much entropy the system can have. And the entropy of any system better be smaller or equal than the area over 4, where area is the area of the... So if you surround the system with a ball or with something, that ball will have some area. And so this is the area of that ball. So area of the surrounding region and you can read Bekenstein's paper about proof of this statement here, but actually there is a very, very simple proof which we will do in tomorrow's tutorial, where we will not exactly prove that it's area over 4, but we will prove that there is a bound on how much entropy can be stored in a system of given, you know, dimensions and stuff like that. So see tutorial for not really a proof, but for an indication that this may be true. For indication. And why this is actually useful is that it really that proof is like two lines, right? So So it's good to have some kind of indication that there may be a bound on how much entropy is stored in any system based on how big the system is. Okay. Questions? So now, I told you yesterday that the black hole entropy never decreases, right? That if I take, there's this second law, that ds is bigger or equal than zero, right? However, now you may be thinking, well, he's actually lying to us, right? Because if the Hawking radiation evaporates the black hole is getting smaller. Well, the area is getting smaller. So actually, we can violate the ds bigger than zero quantum mechanically, right? So then, you know, what is true is that you have to upgrade this to include also the entropy of this Hawking radiation, which is coming up. Okay, and so there is a generalized second law. Second law, which is basically saying that it's only the total entropy, which is by the way amazing, right? I don't know how these people came up with their names, but black hole, Bekenstein, Hawking, right? So this is amazing, right? So they were just born to do this, right? Plus S outside of the black hole never decreases. Okay, so that's the generalized second law, and you will see how this actually gets generalized in the when you will discuss entanglement entropy and you will discuss gravitational entropy of systems. All right, so that's the generalized second law. So even if the black hole entropy can decrease because the black hole is getting smaller, then this is compensated by, you know, what is coming out and, you know, how much entropy is actually being produced in this Hawking radiation. So why you can violate this thing here? So of course the second law by, you know, Hawking previously in these four laws was derived provided that some energy conditions are satisfied for the matter. And indeed, you know, what was required was like null energy condition, some very important energy condition, which is supposed to be satisfied for normal matter. But Hawking radiation actually violates this condition. So that's why this guy can be negative. Okay, so Hawking radiation is a quantum mechanical feature, and that can violate classical energy conditions. That's why this guy can be negative.
It can decrease or it can be negative.
Sorry?
Decrease or it can be negative?
What is it I'm saying? We want delta S, right? Thank you. D. Thank you. Oh, very good. Thank you. That's very good. Very good. So now the question is, I showed you last time that there is this useful Euclidean trick, how you can calculate the temperature by simply saying, well, I just Euclideanize my time, I do the Wick rotation on my time, and then I require that the new space-time, well, really space, does not have any singularities where it didn't have before. So on the horizon, there is no singularity, and that actually fixed the periodicity of this Euclidean time. And that better be, you know, related to some kind of temperature and so on. So now, so you can derive the temperature by this Euclidean trick. But you can go even further. You can actually derive the entropy as well. And that comes from the fact that really you can calculate something like a partition function by doing the Euclidean path integral. Okay, so now entropy formula can be derived from calculating the partition function and so the formula for this partition function is like the path integral. But now you are doing it in the Euclidean setting. And what you do is that you take the Euclidean action. You evaluate it on any possible metrics with the given periodicity in the Euclidean time. So here, you do all the metrics with fixed periodicity in time, with fixed beta. So you have to include all these metrics which have the same periodicity. But then you can do the WKB approximation, and you say, well, it's always only the classical solutions which have the biggest contribution. And so this is like E minus Euclidean action evaluated at the classical solutions. So this is the classical metric. OK, this sounds very mysterious. So you will not believe me until you calculate it tomorrow. Yeah, again, in the tutorial. Like, really, you will calculate what this partition function is in the Rindler space. Okay. But the question is, what is this Euclidean action here? And so when Lewis was discussing relativity, I hope he shown you the action principle for the Einstein-Hilbert action and stuff like that. So now you basically take that action and Euclideanize it. And so we know that this S Euclidean will have this Einstein-Hilbert term. So it will be d4x r square root of g. Now this is Euclidean, so it's plus 16 pi g. Okay, so that's the Einstein-Hilbert action. Did he also tell you that this action is actually no good?
Ruse did.
Okay, very good. So this action is no good. And the reason is that it's not a well-posed variational principle. So actually, if you start varying this action, you get the Einstein equations all right, but you also get the boundary terms. Okay, so this integration is over some space-time domain omega. And you will have some boundary terms coming from the boundary of of omega. And so typically what you require for your action principle to be well defined is that you fix whatever is happening on the boundary. Your delta q is equal to 0 for particle, right? So if you impose delta g on the boundary is equal to 0, then the boundary term vanishes. And then I get whatever happens in the bulk. But Einstein-Hilbert action is not like that. Rather, you would have to also impose the derivatives of the metric. And of course, that gives you too many conditions, and you cannot solve the Einstein equations then. So for this reason, you have to add the proper boundary term, which kills these unwanted terms, which is called York term. So plus this surface term, d3x, is a mysterious epsilon, square root of h is the boundary metric. Let's call it h. And then there is an extrinsic curvature divided by 8 pi g. OK, so this is a curvature, extrinsic curvature. And so once you include this term here, so this is called York term, York Gibbons Hawking term, if you want. So this is Einstein-Hilbert, this is York. Then your variational principle is actually well posed. So you have killed the requirement on the derivatives of the metric on the boundary. So you can just impose delta h on equal to 0 on the boundary. However, this is still no good. Because if you evaluate this on flat space, you get infinity. Okay, so in flat space you would think, well, my action has to be zero. So can I actually subtract this infinity so that I get zero for flat space? And this is done by adding to this some counter terms. So plus counter terms. and these are to tune the value of the action. So that, for example, in flat space, it gives you zero. And as I said, you know, this thing here will give you infinity, so these counter terms will also be infinite, so that they compensate for infinity, and you get some finite nice value, zero, or something like that. Okay, so this is the total action which you have to consider when you're calculating this partition function. So now, interestingly, in flat space, or, you know, it's not really clear what these counter terms are. Okay, so really, people design some subtraction method. They basically randomly subtract some background with some curvature k0 and to get a finite value. But sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It really depends on what you are doing. If the situation is very simple, you can do it. If it's more complicated, you can't. So in asymptotically flat space, this is problematic. As we shall see, not today, in ADS case, this is much more simple, and there is a unique counter term which you have to add here so that your action is, you know, well defined. Okay, so ADS space again nicer, and then you know what these counter terms really are. Okay, so anyway, so once you have the partition function, you know that the free energy F is given by the statistical physics machinery. So it's given by minus 1 over beta logarithm of this partition function. And this is SE over beta. And once you have the free energy, you can calculate the entropy. And this is minus dF over dt. Okay. And then if you do this calculation for Schwarzschild, you will find that it's A over 4. Okay? So this, you know, calculation here really tells you that, yes, I can also confirm the Bekenstein law for the entropy, that the entropy is given by the area over 4. Okay? Questions?
What's the beta this current setting?
Oh, very good. So beta is the periodicity. So this is in the Euclidean setting where you have the Euclidean time, which is periodic because it's a thermal state. And this thing here is only over the matrix with this periodicity beta. So you know that beta, and you know. So basically what it means is that, for example, when you calculate this d4x here, what it really is d3x times d tau. And d tau has periodicity, and because typically nothing depends on tau, the metric is independent of tau, you can integrate it, and that's what gives you beta. Right? So if I integrate d tau, it gives you beta. You will do this calculation tomorrow in the tutorial for Rindle space, so you will see explicitly how this is done. And in real space, super easy. Okay? Questions? Okay, I have still 5 minutes. That's amazing. So let me tell you what happens in the ADS case. By the way, there is a huge shortcut for calculating. If you don't really want to go through this pain and you simply believe in thermodynamics, you know that the free energy is actually given by the internal energy minus TS. That's the formula from thermodynamics, right? Internal energy for us is the mass of the black hole, okay? So this is the thing which you should recover by doing this painful calculation here, right? You should get M minus TS. If you strongly believe in thermodynamics, you don't have to go through this pain, and you can just calculate M minus TS. That's what gives you free energy. You calculate, and then you calculate the entropy from here. Okay? So that's much easier, and that's what you will do in your homework. Okay? Because I was asked that you don't want long homeworks, so we will not do this calculation, but rather, we will just use M minus TS. Okay, so it'll be easy peasy homework. So now, just one remark. So ADS black holes. So ADS black holes are something like, have you seen ADS black holes? No, okay. So they are like Schwarzschild, but Schwarzschild is, there is no lambda, right? So ADS black holes are solutions. So black hole solutions of Einstein equations with cosmological constant G mu nu plus lambda G mu nu. So this is the cosmological constant. Cosmological constant. Equals to 8 pi g t mu nu, right? So now we included this cosmological constant into our considerations, and we will be focusing on negative cosmological constant. So for us, lambda will be given by something manifestly negative. So we just write it's minus 3 over L square, where L is some, this is called ADS radius. So this is negative. And it's L is called the ADS radius. So really, the units of lambda are 1 over length square. So L has 2/2 units of length. OK, this is just parametrization of the cosmological constant. OK, and then to give you an example, a simple example would be Schwarzschild ADS. And so it's exactly the same metric as we've seen before, minus f dt square plus dr square over f plus r square d omega square, where, however, now our metric function f knows about lambda. So this is how it would look like for Schwarzschild. But now this thing here changes your Einstein equations. And so it changes the metric function f, and it picks up this extra term here. Okay, so this is an example of the simplest ADS black hole. And I'm afraid I have to stop here. So very good. So let me stop here. Questions?
I actually have a question from earlier in today. You were saying that Schwarzschild black holes are unstable. Does the radiation fix that instability, or does that just mean that Schwarzschild black holes don't exist in the
past? Oh, this is the thermodynamic instability. So when you're talking about instabilities, you always have to think about what is the time scale of instability, right? How long the black hole can live without actually something happening. And typically the systems have many, many instabilities. So Schwarzschild black hole is classically stable. If you just do a gravitational perturbation on the Schwarzschild black hole, you send some wave onto the black hole. The black hole gets perturbed, but in the end, it radiates away again some stuff, and then it settles down again to Schwarzschild black hole, which is relatively close to the Schwarzschild black hole which you started with. So classically, it is stable. Quantum mechanically, thermodynamically, it is unstable. So if you really start with a configuration where this black hole would be in thermal equilibrium with some radiation, and you perturb that a little bit, it just dries away. So basically, the black hole start diminishing or start growing up. And in the end, you end up with a state which is very, very far away from the state you started with. So it's thermodynamically unstable. The question is, what is the time scale of this instability? And if it's huge, right, you don't care classically, you are not worried about that the black hole will suddenly disappear quantum mechanically because the time scale is huge, right? And that's the case. That's the case here.
What is the case for the Kerr black hole? Because gravitationally, this is stable to small perturbations.
That's a very good question. I don't know. Is it stable? People have shown, I think, linearized stability of Kerr, but I'm not sure about the nonlinear stability that has been fully proved. But of course, there are these crazy mathematical physicists who's trying to prove that, and the proof is 600 pages and stuff like that, right? So I don't know if it has been foolproofed, shown, but it, of course, physically, it's expected that the Kerr black hole is stable classically.
And when you say it perturbs very far from its initial configuration, is that into a different kind of black hole or just something we don't understand altogether?
Oh, it's something, something can happen, various things can happen, right? So, for example, there's this famous superreddian instability which people are now obsessed very much about, right? And so there you basically happens is that you start with a Kerr black hole, which you know is fast rotating. And so it is super fast rotating. And then if it happens, then there are some, you know, ultralight massive bosons. Then what can happen is that there is an instability, and they have to be massive, and they have to have the mass which is precisely tuned according to the size of the black hole and stuff like that. But if these things do exist, then what would happen is that suddenly this black hole would stop rotating, basically. The J would be something like zero, or, you know, not zero, but much smaller than you started with. So this is big, this is small, okay? But these massive particles will condense around the black hole. And so your final state would be that, well, you started with a normal Kerr black hole, which is a vacuum solution. There's nothing around it, but it's fast rotating. And you end up with a state which is slowly rotating black hole, but now surrounded by a cloud of massive particles, right? So that's one kind of instability you can have. So this is the superreddian instability. And it's a classical instability if these particles do exist, okay? So did it answer the question? Okay, more questions. You always have questions. Okay. So then, you know, next time we will return back to this ADS case, and I will show you that really in that case there are nice counter terms, and I will also show you that these black holes can be thermodynamically stable, and they result in some nice phase transitions and some nice phase diagrams, which actually have direct applications in ADS CFT. Okay.